Good evening and welcome. This is the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, April 16th, 2026. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin with news briefs. Young men more likely than young women to say religion is very important. For decades, it was the reverse. But recent data found that young men were just as likely as young women to make that claim. In a report released on Thursday by Gallup, men aged 18 to 29 surpassed women of the same age group on this metric. Gallup's data spans 2024 to 2025. It's the highest point of expressed religiosity by young men in 25 years, a sharp rise that began in 2022. Young women have remained steady during that same period. Minnesota charges ICE agent with assault. State prosecutors have charged an ICE agent with assault for pointing his gun at the occupants of a car on a highway in Minneapolis. The criminal case announced Thursday is believed to be the first brought against a federal immigration officer involved in the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. Gregory Donald Morgan Jr. is charged with two counts of second-degree assault in the February 5th incident. Hennepin County Attorney Mary Moriarty said Morgan illegally drove along the shoulder of Minnesota's State Highway 62 and pointed his service weapon at two people in a vehicle. House votes to protect Haitian immigrants from deportation. The House of Representatives passed a bill to stop the Trump administration from ending temporary deportation protections for Haitian immigrants. Democrat Ayanna Pressley forced the bill onto the floor by getting four Republicans to support a parliamentary move known as a discharge petition. Three more Republicans voted for the bill, a rare pushback on President Trump's immigration policies. The measure would need to pass the Senate before it heads to the president's desk. Trump announces ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon. The 10-day ceasefire to begin Thursday night pauses a conflict that erupted when the Iran-backed Shia Hezbollah militant group fired rockets into Israel in March in retaliation for U.S. and Israeli airstrikes against Iran. Israel's airstrikes in response have killed 2,196 Lebanese people. More than 1.2 million people are displaced after Israeli forces sought to create a buffer zone in southern Lebanon. On social media, President Donald Trump said Lebanese President Joseph Aoun and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu agreed to the ceasefire in order to achieve peace. Hezbollah has rejected the first direct talks in decades between Israel and the Lebanese government, which took place in Washington Tuesday. House narrowly votes against withdrawing forces from Iran war. A resolution directing President Trump to end hostilities with Iran narrowly failed in the House of Representatives by a vote of 214 to 213, with one member voting present and three not voting. Democratic Representative Jared Golden sided with Republicans to block the measure, while Representative Thomas Massey was the only Republican supporting it. The margin marks a shift in the House's approval of the Iran war. A similar resolution failed 219 to 212 in March. The Senate rejected a war powers resolution Wednesday. Pakistan works to restart peace talks. Continuing to mediate the Mideast conflict, Pakistan dispatched Field Marshal Asim Munir, to meet with Iranian negotiator Mohammad Bagher Khalibaf as the ceasefire creeps closer to its April 22nd expiration. On Thursday, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth threatened to resume bombing if Iran doesn't choose wisely in accepting a peace deal. The U.S. Navy has turned away 13 ships since its blockade of Iran's ports. But according to Shipping Tracker Service Marine Traffic, there's some resumption of traffic in the Strait of Hormuz, including one crude carrier. India considers measures to dramatically reshape Parliament. They would fast-track a law passed in 2023 that mandates 33% of seats, Parliament, and state legislatures be for women. Currently, 14% of legislators in the lower house, or Lok Sabha, are women. It will change the nature of power, activist Ranjana Kumari told the Financial Times. New bills added to the law would expand the Lok Sabha from 543 to 850 seats and potentially shift a greater share of seats to northern India, where the population is growing fastest. Critics say the added bills are a hidden power grab since the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party is strongest in the north. Now on to our stories. Can the U.S. and Iran close off the Strait of Hormuz? What international law says? Washington and Tehran are testing the boundaries of international laws that have managed the seas remarkably well, protecting freedom of navigation and facilitating a global economy. By Mark Sappenfield and Matthew Bell. Iran and the United States have made bold statements about the Strait of Hormuz. Iran says it has the right to police it, demanding fees from transiting ships to pay for reconstruction from an illegal war. The U.S. says it has a right to blockade it, cutting off Iran from lucrative sea lanes in its own waters. But what does international law say? And what might this all mean for the shipping lanes crucial to global commerce going forward? Experts debate some of the details, but most agree Iran is overstepping its rights in one way or another, and that the conclusion reached by the U.S. and Iran will be of enormous consequence. If anyone is allowed to make the Strait of Hormuz a toll booth, decades of carefully crafted international law will be shredded, nudging the maritime world back toward the days of mercurial sultans and Barbary pirates. Which international rules apply? The law that usually holds sway in maritime disputes is the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, or UNCLOS, ratified by 171 nations, including Oman, which claims parts of the strait as its territorial waters. Under UNCLOS, the Strait of Hormuz is an international strait, meaning it can't be closed for any reason. So long as a ship doesn't dally in an international strait, it has an absolutely unsuspendable right of passage, says Mark Weller, director of the Global Governance and Security Center at Chatham House, a London-based think tank. One issue here is that neither the U.S. nor Iran has officially ratified UNCLOS. In this case, legal rights are generally determined by what is called customary international law, a set of near-universal expectations based on countries' policies and practices. When it comes to maritime trade routes, customary law gives nations slightly more leeway in their own territorial waters. Yet, even customary law recognizes the right of innocent passage. That means ships can move through another nation's waters so long as they do so expeditiously and do not threaten or take advantage of the host nation. Who is in violation and how? Some experts say elements of UNCLOS have effectively become customary law and, as a result, the Strait of Hormuz is an international strait with right of passage, regardless of whether Iran ratified the treaty. Iran rejects that argument. They never officially recognized the Strait of Hormuz as an international strait, and therefore they exercised the option of hampering shipping traffic anytime they wanted, says Farzin Nadimi, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Yet the Islamic Republic has never done anything remotely on this scale, and even if Iran is not bound by UNCLOS, the right of passage in customary law is clear. Under innocent passage, one would expect any such measures by Iran to be directed only at U.S. or Israeli vessels, rather than all ships, says Maria Garcia Casas, a professor of public international law at the Autonomous University of Madrid, in an email interview. There is another wrinkle. In war, the laws of naval warfare apply to combatants. For neutral states, that shouldn't make much difference. Ships flagged to neutral countries should be able to proceed unimpeded. However, U.S. President Donald Trump initially said all traffic through the area would be blocked. Military officials later said the blockade applied only to Iran-linked vessels. A BBC attempt to verify the impact of the American blockade by analyzing ship tracking data was inconclusive. The laws of naval warfare would also complicate a proposal for the U.S. to escort tankers through the strait. Any merchant vessel traveling in a convoy under the protection of a belligerent warship is subject to attack, says Natalie Klein, a legal expert at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, in an email. What does the war mean for shipping in the future? Here, most experts agree that the stakes are extremely high. Until the Iran war, the international law governing the seas was going so fine that no one thought about it, says Mark Nevitt, a retired U.S. Navy commander, now a professor at Emory Law School in Atlanta. The war could blow a hole through those laws. If we had an outcome where the U.S. negotiates a deal that somehow accepts Iranian and Omani control over the strait, that would challenge the universal agreement that all straits are open to all ships of all nations, under all circumstances. And that would be very dangerous, says Mr. Weller of Chatham House. To find similar examples, historians need to go back centuries. A Financial Times report examining the practice of taxing international waterways points to the fee Denmark exacted on vessels passing between the North Sea and Baltic Sea, starting in the 15th century. Not much later, the Portuguese Empire took control of Hormuz Island to control and profit from trade in the Indian Ocean. Famously, America's first wars as an independent nation in the early 19th century were against Barbary pirates, who demanded a fee to leave ships in the Mediterranean unharmed. Professor Klein hopes the resolution of this war will strengthen international law. To collect tolls would be entirely contrary to navigational rights that have been enjoyed for decades through international straits, she says. If anything, the conflict has highlighted how important navigational rights are for all states, and why those rights need to be protected. Next story. Cameroon's separatist conflict drove its pro soccer teams out. Why, they're back. The return of professional soccer to one of Cameroon's Anglophone regions reflects a cautious optimism about the future in a place upended by war. By Umbo Promise. Reporting from Bamenda, Cameroon. On an afternoon in early April, the stands of the small soccer stadium here slowly fill with fans dressed in the blue and white jerseys of the home team, PWD Bamenda. Vendors balancing trays of chips and bottled drinks on their heads weave between the red plastic seats as the two teams warm up on the pitch. There is nothing remarkable about the scene, and for the people here, that's exactly what makes it extraordinary. For the last decade, daily life in this part of Cameroon has been warped by a brutal conflict between the country's government and a militia fighting for an independent state for Cameroon's English-speaking minority. The conflict is the focus of Thursday's visit by to Bamenda by Pope Leo XIV, which also led separatists to declare a three-day pause in fighting this week. Among the many casualties of the fighting between the state and the separatists has been the region's raucous soccer culture. 5 years ago, attacks against coaches and players pushed local professional teams out of the region. This season, however, they are back home, a return that signals for many here a new optimism about the future, both on and off the soccer pitch. For a long time, people were mourning, explains Forti Forche Endefor, head of the team's fan club. Now, they are beginning to rejoice through football. Sports under fire. The soccer stadium in Bamenda sits on ferociously contested land. This part of Cameroon was once under British rule, but it joined together with the neighboring territory of French Cameroon at independence. Though the newly independent Cameroon was ostensibly bilingual, Francophones were 80% of the population, and they quickly became the ruling elite. In 2016, Anglophone anger over decades of marginalization spilled into the streets, as English speakers turned out to protest the appointment of hundreds of French-speaking judges and teachers in their regions. Police and the military cracked down violently. That, in turn, gave new momentum to a small band of armed men who had long called for an independent Anglophone state called Ambazonia. Soon the government and the separatists were at war. Since then, the fighting has driven more than a half million people in Cameroon's two English-speaking regions from their homes. Separatists have also shown their strength by shutting down entire towns and destroying institutions run by the government, from schools to hospitals to stadiums. Soccer was not spared. The stadium of Bamenda's two professional teams, Yong Sports Academy and PWD Bamenda, was in a red zone where separatists and soldiers routinely clashed. As a result, beginning in 2017, the teams and their opponents had to be escorted to games by the police. Then, in March 2019, the team's worst fear came true when Yong Sports Academy coach Emmanuel Ndube Bosso was abducted by gunmen while driving to training. He was released in less than 24 hours, but 2 weeks later, five armed men stormed the pitch during a PWB Bamenda practice and took that team's coach, at the time Augustine Chupo, hostage overnight. Conflict deepens. That period also marked the peak of the fighting between the Ambazonians and the government. The army torched entire villages thought to shelter separatists, raping and murdering residents. The insurgents, meanwhile, attacked police and soldiers, but also teachers and students who refused to participate in their boycotts of schools. Designed to pressure the government, the education boycott was so successful that by 2019, only 19% of schools in Anglophone Cameroon were still open, and some 600,000 children were out of school. Young Sports Academy fan Sama Rene was one of them. Many of us thought the rebellion was something good that would really bring change, says Mr. Rene, who was never able to return to school. Losing his chance at an education, he says, soured him on the separatists' cause. As attacks and threats against the soccer teams continued, the league made the decision to move both teams out of Bamenda. Beginning in 2021, they played their home matches in cities in the neighboring Francophone region, a drive of up to 2 hours from their home city. Most fans were unable to make the journey. That affects the team more than people think, says Tama Wango, the current head coach of PWD Bamenda. For the next 4 years, the teams shuttled back and forth between practices in Bamenda and games in their new home stadium. Meanwhile, in their actual home, the conflict simmered on. Every Monday, separatists made Bamenda a ghost town, forcing all businesses to close, public transport to halt, and residents to stay home. Those who resisted were sometimes killed. In 2022, a PWD Bamenda fan named Mary was kidnapped for selling beers brewed in the Francophone region and considered banned foreign products by the separatists. A ransom of 800,000 Central African francs, about $1,500, secured her release. The shop where the beers were sold was my only source of income, but I had to abandon it for my safety, says Mary, who is being referred to by her first name out of continuing fears for her security. Coming home. Even as fighting continued, however, Bamenda's two soccer teams were desperate to come home. Ahead of the 2025 season, they threatened to boycott the league if they could not play in their own stadium again. League organizers assented, but the season had barely begun when, in February 2025, armed fighters fired shots outside the stadium during a PWD Bamenda match. A shootout with security forces ensued. Fans and players fled, and the teams once again withdrew to the Francophone region. But later that year, construction began on a new stadium in a safer part of Bamenda, and on February 1st, about 1,200 fans turned up to watch PWD Bamenda defeat Stade Renard 4-1. At the game this month, PWD Bamenda fan Tize Hillary reflects on what his team's homecoming has meant, describing it as a moment of release. "We needed that after so many years," he says, as other spectators around him nod in agreement. Indeed, for a few hours during this match, the tension that often defines daily life here appears to soften. In the stands, friends argue over the team's missed chances for a goal. Strangers exchange greetings. "I come here to forget," says Bernard Ndim. For years, he followed PWD Bamenda from a distance, unable to afford transport to the relocated home matches. "We have heard so much bad news, gunshots, killings," he says. "Now, when I sit here, I feel like I'm healing through football." You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of reading from over 200 publications. Next story. the first woman to complete the Boston Marathon, sculpt her own legacy. When Bobby Gibb sprang out of the bushes and into the Boston Marathon, she proved women could run 26.2 miles. A new sculpture she crafted at the race start makes her legacy. Marks Her Legacy by Kendra Norden Beto, reporting from Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Above the colorful sea of 30,000 runners who will check their watches and bounce from foot to foot to soothe last-minute jitters at the start of the Boston Marathon, April 20th, will be a new stationary figure, standing as a tribute to those who came before. The Girl Who Ran depicts Roberta Bobby Gibb, the first woman to complete the marathon in 1966. Cast in bronze and captured mid-stride, eyes focused straight ahead, Ms. Gibb, an accomplished artist, is also the sculptor of the life-size monument. 60 years ago, 100 yards from this spot, she hid in a forsythia bush, her long hair tucked beneath a hooded sweatshirt. She waited, coiled like a spring, to leap into a race not open to women. Times have clearly changed. On Monday, when the runners line up for the 130th Boston Marathon, women will make up nearly half of the competitors. Ms. Gibbs's statue may represent a moment of her personal history, but to the artist it embodies much more. I also want it to be for not just women, but men and women, because much as women were locked into a stereotype, so were men. We were segregated, she says in a phone interview from her home on the North Shore of Massachusetts. A recent ribbon-cutting ceremony at The Girl Who Ran marked the culmination of a nearly decade-long fundraising effort by Boston Marathon winners and private donors. The effort was coordinated by the 26.2 Foundation, a nonprofit dedicated to advancing the sport. The Girl Who Ran is not only the first Boston Marathon-related statue to represent a real woman, but it is also a rarity among public works of art. Most monuments that portray female figures are allegorical, such as the Statue of Liberty, says Sierra Rooney, an associate professor of art history at the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse. Her research shows there are around 400 monuments honoring real women in the United States, about 8% of all monuments. Dr. Rooney is particularly struck by The Girl Who Ran because it depicts a living person created by the athlete herself. It is about the physical strength of a female body, and that's quite unusual in the landscape of public monuments, says Dr. Rooney. The cultural conception of what it means to be a hero has so long been bounded by sort of masculine ideals of being a politician, being a statesman, being an explorer, these professions that historically have excluded women. The number of public works honoring women is slowly increasing. There are about 16 statues of women in sport in the U.S., most installed in the past decade, says Dr. Rooney, who is assembling a database of public monuments. The first statue of a woman athlete that she knows of is one of Joan Benoit Samuelson, the winner of the first women's Olympic marathon in 1984, installed in 1986 in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. Ms. Benoit Samuelson is also a two-time Boston Marathon champion and a donor behind The Girl Who Ran. The Olympian has her own running statuette sculpted by Ms. Gibb, one of her cherished possessions, presented to her at the 1984 Olympic trials. Ms. Gibb had created one for each of the top three American finishers. When you think of women and Boston, clearly Bobby should be the one who's recognized, says Ms. Benoit Samuelson in a phone interview. Her statue should be at the start because she really started women's marathoning here in the United States. That is her place in history and in time. Prove this misconception about women wrong. For Ms. Gibb, who grew up outside Boston, running in the woods for the joy of movement and to commune with nature, the vision of watching the marathon runners as a college student in 1964 took her breath away. I had never actually seen a group of human beings running like that together, and I felt very moved by it, she says. I knew I wanted to be part of it. Over the next 2 years, she gradually increased her distances. She ran between her family's home in Winchester and Tufts University, where she was a student, and the Museum of Fine Arts, where she was taking art classes. Wearing sturdy leather nurse's shoes and a swimsuit under shorts as her training gear, in the snowy winter months, she layered on long underwear and wore a pair of boys' buckle galoshes over layers of wool socks. A marriage and a move to San Diego, California, did not deter her quest. She wrote to the Boston Marathon organizers to request entry. They refused. Women were not physiologically capable of running 26.2 miles, their reply stated, and they couldn't risk giving her a number. The Amateur Athletic Union sanctioned the competition as men only. She crumpled the letter and threw it across the floor. In that moment, the tranquility she felt while running was joined by something else, rage. I took off out the door, and I ran 20 miles north to Del Mar Beach. I was so upset, says Ms. Gibb. She fell asleep on the beach, and when she awoke, she knew she had to run the upcoming marathon. It was no longer just an endurance race. It was an opportunity. If I can prove this misconception about women wrong, then it's going to throw into question all the other false beliefs about women that have been used literally for centuries to keep women from really manifesting their potential, she recalls thinking at the time. So she boarded a bus and traveled 4 days back to Boston, arriving the evening before the race. Her mother, a housewife who disapproved of her daughter's free-spirited ways, finally agreed to drop young Bobby off at the start line the next morning. That's where Ms. Gibb hid in the bushes, wearing a pair of her brother's Bermuda shorts, her swimsuit, a hooded sweatshirt, and a brand new pair of boys' running shoes. After the fastest runners had passed, Ms. Gibb joined the 500 men churning toward Boston. It wasn't long before she could hear the runners behind her saying, "Is that a girl?" So she turned and smiled. I said, "I'm afraid if they see I'm a woman, they'll throw me out," Ms. Gibb recalls. And the guys around me said, "We won't let them throw you out. It's a free road." They were on my side. We had a great time. A local radio station also spotted Ms. Gibb on the course and broadcast her progress, clipping along at a sub-3-hour pace until blisters from her new shoes slowed her down. By the time she crossed the finish line in 3 hours, 21 minutes, and 40 seconds, faster than 2/3 of the field that day, the governor of Massachusetts was waiting to shake her hand. Ms. Gibb returned in 1967 to run again without official sanction. Her finish was overshadowed by the second woman to cross the finish line that year. Nearly an hour behind her, Catherine Switzer had obtained an official number by disguising her gender as K. Switzer on her application. When an official spotted Ms. Switzer on the course, he tried to tear off her bib to prevent the race from losing its accreditation. A photojournalist caught the scene, and the series of photos has since become part of the iconic history of women running in the Boston Marathon. Ms. Gibb was also the first woman to cross in 1968, followed by two other women runners. But by then, the media frenzy had moved on from the first few trailblazers. The Boston Marathon officially opened to women in 1972. At the 100th anniversary in 1996, the Boston Athletic Association awarded Ms. Gibb with a medal that listed her three first-place finishes and included her name in the winner's ring on the Boston Marathon Monument. Now, the girl who ran bookends the course, honoring Ms. Gibb and those who followed, and inspiring those yet to line up to run 26.2 miles to Boston, such as Joy Donahue, a Hopkinton resident. Ms. Donahue will join 14,000 other women at the start of her 10th Boston Marathon this year. I train in the area, and I plan to touch Bobby's shoes every time I run by, so they eventually turn shiny and bright, says Ms. Donahue, who came to the ribbon-cutting ceremony. Ms. Gibb is quick to say that although she was the only woman running down Boylston Street to finish that day in 1966, she was hardly alone in her efforts to break barriers. The statue of a young woman wearing a swimsuit or Bermuda shorts symbolizes all the pioneer women in running, but also the way women have fought for and attained equal or almost equal rights, civil and human rights, around the world, says Ms. Gibb. My run in 1966 was like a match lighting the fire, and that's exactly what I wanted to happen. Next story. As U.S. blocks Strait of Hormuz, Navy prepares for showdowns. America's military blockade of the Strait of Hormuz has choked off shipping, a move to force Iran to negotiate. The strategy could escalate tensions. By Anna Mulreen Grobe. As the U.S. military announced this week that its blockade of the Iranian coast is in full effect, it was also sending another U.S. aircraft carrier, the USS George H.W. Bush, escorted by Navy warships, to the Middle East. That brings roughly 6,000 more troops to the region, who could be used to bolster blockade efforts or to strike back if Iran makes good on its threats to retaliate against the United States for closing its ports. The plan, as U.S. officials see it, is to pressure Tehran to negotiate before a shaky two-week ceasefire expires next week. "We can do this all day," Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said in a press briefing Thursday. Whether that is true remains to be seen. For now, U.S. sailors are working with little respite. The USS Gerald R. Ford, ordered from the Mediterranean to the Caribbean for the capture of former Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro in January, then to the Middle East in February, reached its 296th day of deployment Wednesday, setting a post-Vietnam War record. Ship traffic through the strategically vital strait, meanwhile, has dropped significantly and appears little changed since the blockade began Monday, even as two U.S. Navy destroyers entered the strait last week to start mine-clearing operations. The problem is that vessels, both military and commercial, could be even more vulnerable to mines and other potential Iranian strikes when leaving the strait than when coming into it. Admiral Darrell Caudle, Chief of Naval Operations, warned Wednesday in a discussion at the Atlantic Council. Ship owners and crews who don't want their ships blown up are sensitive to such possibilities. But if peace talks progress and vessel traffic picks up, the Navy could become a victim of its own success, as the pace of operations compounds the difficulty of the mission, says retired Navy officer Brian McGrath, who previously commanded one of the guided missile destroyers, now taking part in Operation Epic Fury. The Navy has not yet needed to board any ships, General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said during a Pentagon briefing Thursday morning. Should they be called upon to do that, though, the blockade mission could get more complicated, Mr. McGrath says. The Navy could, for example, interdict Chinese-flagged vessels carrying Iranian oil through the strait, a scenario that could grow even more fraught were the tankers to be escorted by Chinese warships, he notes. Throughout the operation, the U.S. military must navigate the strict rules of engagement and enforcement prescribed by centuries of Navy tradition and treaties surrounding blockades. Altogether, Admiral Caudill added Wednesday, this is a major undertaking. Strait moves and countermoves. Some 10,000 U.S. troops, along with a dozen warships and more than 100 aircraft, are currently taking part in the Strait of Hormuz blockade, according to U.S. Central Command, which runs U.S. military operations in the Middle East. On Tuesday, an Iranian-flagged cargo vessel tried to evade the blockade, but a U.S.-guided missile destroyer successfully redirected the vessel, which is heading back to Iran, the command said. No ships have yet broken through the blockade, and 10 merchant vessels complied with direction from U.S. forces to turn around and re-enter an Iranian port on the Gulf of Oman, U.S. Central Command added. For now, having withdrawn most of its ships from the Persian Gulf before the war began, the Navy is intercepting and redirecting ships in the Gulf of Oman. The Strait of Hormuz connects these two bodies of water. About 20 miles wide at its narrowest point, the strait has shipping lanes that are narrower still, with a width of just about 2 miles in each direction. As transiting ships are funneled into these lanes, they become easier targets for Iran. Along its mountainous coastline are man-made wet tunnels where Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is believed to have hidden weapons and speedboats. Those arms and boats can be used to defend Iran, but also to attack passing ships. The U.S. Navy has its own defenses, including radar systems to detect enemy missiles and drones, and surface-to-air missiles and guns to shoot them down. The Navy is also starting to use helicopters launched from ships and equipped with guns that can shoot down enemy drones. To date, these have been one of the best tools the Navy has for defending ships against Iran's Shahed drones, Mr. McGrath says. U.S. sailors got plenty of practice defending against these sorts of weapons through the Navy's campaign against Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen, who have attacked U.S. ships 174 times since 2023. Perhaps as a nod to this threat, in its travels east to the Arabian Sea, the USS George H.W. Bush is diverting and going around the coast of Africa rather than taking the standard route through the Mediterranean and Red Seas, an effort, some analysts say, to avoid Houthi attacks that the group carries out in solidarity with Iran. With missiles at a premium and laser weapons that could help protect Navy ships against drones still in the development stages and fraught with glitches, the Navy's surface fleet in the coming years might avoid operating in waters within range of drones and anti-ship missiles, a 2024 Congressional Research Service report warned. Iranian missiles that left U.S. military bases in the Gulf region badly damaged have raised questions as well about whether the Navy's Fifth Fleet, home to 9,000 U.S. personnel, will ever return to its base in Bahrain. Is it legal? Despite Iran's claims that the blockade is an act of war that could upend the ceasefire deal, it has so far been carried out in keeping with the laws of naval warfare, says Raul Pedroso, professor of the law of armed conflict at the U.S. Naval War College. The United States, because it is fighting a war, has the absolute right to stop every neutral vessel at sea to determine whether or not it's carrying contraband, he argues. That said, you have to apply it cautiously, because you don't want to be accused of interfering with neutral trade. For a blockade to be legal, it must also be impartially applied to friends and foes alike, Professor Pedroso says. This could create tensions with Chinese-flagged vessels, for example, since the state under whose flag a ship sails, in this case China, has exclusive jurisdiction over that vessel in times of peace. That exclusive jurisdiction goes away during an international armed conflict, Professor Pedroso says. This definitely could strain relationships with other countries. The Chinese Foreign Ministry has pronounced the U.S. blockade dangerous and irresponsible. To avoid having Chinese flagged ships boarded, Beijing could use its own Navy warships to escort them in a sort of dare to U.S. forces, Mr. Clark says. The U.S. probably won't shoot on any of these ships, right? Doing so, he adds, would amount to attacking a third party just for trying to escort its oil out. Given that the United States would be unlikely to respond in this scenario, it would amount to an opportunity to poke the U.S. in the eye, he says. It's a way of embarrassing the U.S. that could be really beneficial for China. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona for the Print Disabled. Next story. More liberals are buying guns. Why? Rising gun ownership among Democrats is reshaping U.S. gun culture and recalibrating the debate between gun rights, civic safety, and government control. By Patrick Johnson, reporting from Rome, Georgia. On a hillside outside Rome, Georgia, a sign on a small building announces a firm called Osprey Shooting Solutions, whose Latin motto translates to, "In peace, like a wise man, he should make suitable preparation for war." Next door is a dusty gun range where a man practices quick draw fire with a trainer behind him. The pop, pop, pop of small arms fire fills the air. Rural ranges like this have often been seen as the purview of white conservative men, some of whom style themselves as citizen protectors. Yet owner Edgar Mills, a former Green Beret soldier, is a key player in what has become a noticeable shift in who owns firearms in the United States and why. In the last couple of years, a growing number of women and people of color have begun training with Mr. Mills. His clients are conservatives, moderates, liberals, and those who defy simple labels altogether. His star student is Eva, a former infantry soldier who appears at the range in pink stockings and painted nails. In some ways, Mr. Mills's expansive view of gun ownership is still unusual in a firearm culture often associated with support for President Donald Trump and his villainization of Democrats and progressive politics. Yet, those who see the Second Amendment's right to bear arms as a bulwark against oppressive government are beginning to include liberals, who increasingly find themselves in political and social crosshairs. Laying out the welcome mat to Democrats and others who don't fit a traditional conservative gun owner profile has become good business. especially at a time when gun sales, which peaked at about 22 million in 2020, have slowed. Gun owners who lean left politically are looking for an accepting place where people aren't stink-eyeing them, says Mr. Mills, whose solid physique hints at years of war zone deployments. Nobody wants to be in an environment where they're not wanted. Across the U.S., gun ownership by people who identify as politically left of center is rising. One NBC News survey showed that the number of Democratic households with guns rose from 33% in 2019 to 41% 5 years later. Other studies confirm that gun culture is now far more diverse than is often portrayed in the media, and that Second Amendment activism is a key driver for many new gun owners. Current events and politics, experts and observers say, are playing a role in who carries what and why. A trend that began with women and black people outbuying white men at gun shops during the COVID-19 pandemic accelerated with the fatal shooting of Alex Pretty in Minneapolis in January, according to liberal gun rights groups. A legal gun carrier who never drew his weapon, Mr. Pretty was killed as he tried to help a woman knocked down by federal immigration enforcement agents. His death raised the stakes among some left-leaning Americans worried about armed agents trampling their civil rights. In the process, some Americans have shifted from opposing guns to embracing them, setting up new political dynamics in a restive America. What has changed with Trump's second term and the Alex Pretty incident is the idea that guns aren't just for personal self-defense, but may also be to resist government tyranny, says David Yamani, author of Gun Curious, a liberal professor's surprising journey inside America's gun culture. This becomes a challenge for a lot of centrist liberals because they place a lot of faith in the state, he adds. Then they see what could go wrong if the state falls into the wrong hands. Why buy a gun? Broadly, polls consistently show that Republicans support gun ownership at much higher rates than Democrats, as the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. One banner showed a Confederate battle flag with an assault-style weapon and the taunt, "Come and take it." Democrats, by contrast, traditionally favor stricter gun laws. In 2019, when former Texas Representative Beto O'Rourke declared, "Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47, at a Democratic presidential primary debate to endorse a mandatory buyback program for assault-style weapons, the audience's cheer drowned out the rest of his answer. In recent years, gun ownership as a political statement and for political reasons has accelerated, with more citing the need for self-defense and liberal gun organizations seeing heightened interest. That sales growth has blunted the Trump slump for the firearms industry, which usually sees lower sales when gun owners feel confident that a new president is protecting gun carry rights. Professor Yamani, a sociologist at Wake Forest University in North Carolina, began studying gun culture a decade ago to understand its mainstream appeal. To better understand it, he ended up buying a gun himself. The move was unusual and unpopular among his peers, he says, and has been a solitary experience. But he's not so lonely anymore. While gun sales have fallen from a high water mark in 2021, annual sales still hover around 15 million each year and are still higher than before the pandemic, according to The Trace, a nonprofit publication that reports on U.S. gun violence. Nearly 5 million guns were sold in the first 4 months of 2025, it says. LA Progressive Shooters, a gun education group in Los Angeles that welcomes people regardless of their politics, has had to expand its increasingly sold-out training sessions. Another nationwide group based in Newton, Massachusetts, the Liberal Gun Club, saw its membership rise by 66%, from 2,700 members to 4,500. In the year before Mr. Preddy's shooting, the organization passed its total 2025 training numbers in the first 3 months of 2026. Some of the new gun groups eschew political affiliations. Others cater mostly to liberals. In Shelton, Connecticut, for example, an organization named A Better Way 2A promotes gun rights for progressives and sells a variety of merchandise, including stickers that say, "You can't vote away fascism, buy a gun." The Socialist Rifle Association, founded in Kansas in 2018, claims 10,000 donors and says it seeks to advance an inclusive, safe, and healthy firearms culture in America to combat the toxic right-wing and exclusionary firearm culture in place today. Owning a gun now is not an automatic indicator that you're most likely a conservative, says Jordan Levine, co-founder of A Better Way 2A. You have far more people who are politically involved, Gen Z and millennials especially, who see things and feel this dread that your most paranoid conservative gun owners have felt for so long. But now it's not liberals coming for your guns, but conservatives coming for our rights. For those who see guns as problems, not solutions, the trend is jarring. Most researchers agree that stricter gun laws save lives, though Americans are still split on whether gun rights or gun control is more important. For Mr. Mills, preserving expanded gun rights helps protect all Americans from government overreach. Not that he doesn't worry about gun safety for the public at large, but that's a quandary, he says, he cannot solve. What we know about the government is, if you give them an inch, they take a mile. That's it. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, April 16th, 2026. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for listening. Good night.